May we have the ears to hear and a heart to respond. In Jesus' precious and holy name. Amen. Well, the passage is kind of off in the bulletin, and that's not Sandy's fault. It's mine, because I was going to preach last Sunday night, but we didn't have last Sunday night, and so I bumped the messages back like I've done this morning, but she had already done the bulletin, getting ready for vacation because her mom's in town from Ohio. And so, to none of her fault, mine, but I think that you will easily be able to find the passage, because it's one chapter prior to that, in chapter 21 of 2 Kings. We looked at Hezekiah, and we saw in Hezekiah a man really in three movements. We saw three different occasions in Hezekiah's life, two of which when he went before the Lord and great and magnificent things happened, and the third time when the Lord came before Hezekiah and it really turned south. And instead of responding like he had responded in the prior two, he pretty much his response was, "Oh, well, it won't happen to me. Let my kids deal with it." And that's how the chapter ended, other than it told one thing about his accomplishments, and that was the tunnel he had made down to the pool to be able to have water during a time of siege, which would come because of the things that he had done. So I guess in kind of a in one way, he had prepared for the things that he had done in showing all of his treasure and wealth to the Babylonians, but it would be very little, and it would not be sufficient. Because the Lord was not going to be in it with them and for them. But we look at his son, and this son begins reign at 12 years old. He's born during that period of time when Hezekiah prayed out to God and said, "God, you know, I don't want to die. Don't let me die. You know, I want to live." And he was crying out before God. God gave him 15 years. And so if he lives 15 more years, and this child begins reigning at 12, then he had to have been born after Hezekiah had recovered, correct? So what kind, you know, our kids learn from us. Good, bad, or indifferent, they learn from us, don't they? They learn a lot from us. They're not entirely 100% us. I mean, even though they may be mirror images of us in many of our behaviors, they still have to make a commitment in the way that they walk with the Lord or don't walk with the Lord. And so Manasseh had to make that decision, but he learned a lot from his father in the 12 years that he knew him, in the latter part of Hezekiah's life, because the last part of Hezekiah's life wasn't like the beginning, because his commitment to the Lord had waned. It wasn't the bright star, the stellar condition that it had been prior. And so we look at Manasseh as a 12-year-old boy, and he reigned a long time, because it says he reigns 55 years. That makes, he was 67 when he died. Now, antiquity, that's a long time. 55 years to reign. 52, anything over 30 years is a long time. And so he reigns for 55 years. So he's there a long time, and his influence will be a lasting influence. And so we begin reading in chapter 21. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hephzibah. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight, imitating the abominations of the nations that the Lord had dispossessed before the Israelites. He rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had destroyed and reestablished the altars for Baal. He made an Asherah, as King Ahab of Israel had done. He also worshipped the whole heavenly host and served them. He would build altars in the Lord's temple, where the Lord had, had said, "Jerusalem is where I will put my name." He built altars to the whole heavenly host in both the courtyards of the temples of the Lord's temple, the inner court, the outer court. He made his sons pass through the fire, practice witchcraft and divination, and consulted mediums and spirits. He did a great amount of evil in the Lord's sight, provoking him. If that's all we read, that is bad enough. But it gets worse. Everything his father had done in committing to the Lord, to walk with the Lord, he undid. In my mind, "God, if I'm going to mess up the latter end, then let me die before I get there. Don't let me live too long. I don't want to be here too long. If the latter part of my life, I'm just going to mess it all up, then let me leave before that happens. I'd rather be dead than to do this, to bring about to undo everything that had been done. Again, I think about the words of Brother Bob, who is my senior. Brother Bob says, I don't worry about how I ran the race. I worry about what? How I finish. Anyone here considering how you're going to finish the race? Anyone here ever race? Ever run track, cross country? You know, all right, Gary ran. All right, and so did Chris. You know, the thing is somebody sets the pace right off the start. If it's a long distance run, somebody sets the pace, don't they? And the goal of the runners is to run at that pace and to come along. My problem is I've got one speed. I got one gear. And I get up to that one gear, and I can run it the whole race, but I don't have a kick at the last. So whenever I ran cross country or I ran in the track, my whole purpose is to get everybody exhausted at the end of it or at the first of it so that somebody could kind of hold back and kick off at the end of it because I wasn't going to win. But I could kick the speed up at the first of it, and, you know, if it was a mile or if it was 2 miles, whatever the race was, 5 miles, I had the speed pretty quick going off, and by the time we got done, some of the guys that generally ended well, they were huffing and puffing because they spent everything they had at the first part of the race trying to stay with the pack, and then when they got to the end, they were like me, they died. As they were crossing the finish line, it just got, you know, the gas went out, and you crash over the finish line and you just kind of die off to the side, and it didn't matter because you weren't the one getting the trophy and everyone wasn't cheering, you know, because you were the dead guy that they were dragging off. So for me, the finish wasn't the issue. For me, it was the start. It was what I did at the start. You know, they pay guys like that to do that with the marathons, these 25 or 22 mile runs. They pay someone to pick the pace up that gets out there, and they have no intention that they're going to even finish the race. But what they want them to do is they want to get the pace up and to put the leaders ahead of the pack and to shorten the time of the ultimate race. And they pay guys to do that. The funny thing is that every once in a while, the guy that they pay to be the kickoff guy sometimes wins. And, you know, he gets out there and he's able to maintain the pace and he keeps on going and he stays ahead of the pack and the pack never catches up with him because they burn out during the course of the race. You know, it's the only time you get paid for leading laps is in the Indy 500. You get paid for every lap that you lead in the race. But the big package comes for whom? Who gets the big prize? The guy who finishes the race first, right? All right, so you run and you led, you know, three quarters of the race. It doesn't matter if you led three quarters of the race. If you fall out, you fall down, or you just give up, or you crawl across the finish line, it doesn't matter that you led three quarters of it, because the only one who wins is whom? The guy who goes across first. So the race isn't about how you're running the first three quarters, is it? It's about what's your plan to finish the race. Some of us don't have a plan for finishing the race. And here we find Hezekiah, because Hezekiah is not, he looks at what he's done, and God's favorable towards him. I mean, God was blessing him in everything he did. The Bible says that in chapter 20. It says that God blessed him. There was no one like David before or after him. But he didn't finish well. He died, he puttered out on the last leg when he lived too long, when he lived 15 years more than what he had planned to live. He lived too long and he puttered out. He didn't finish the race well. And his son didn't start the race well. And if you don't start the race well, you probably won't finish it well either, will you? If you jump the gun, it doesn't matter what sport it is, if you jump the line and you go ahead, even in football today, you know, we're watching and the guy on the defense jumps across the line before the ball snaps, and then they snap the ball, what is that? It's an infraction. And there's a penalty, isn't it, that comes with that. And so yardage they may not have gotten. The offense gets, you know, 5 yards because of an offsides. And the 5 yards may be all it needs to get them to the first down to be able to keep moving the ball down. Otherwise, it may have been a stalemate and they'd had to punt the ball and they wouldn't have gotten anywhere. But now they may make a touchdown because you gave them a first down by your infraction. So we understand that. Well, what's his infraction? Look at it again. Everything his father had torn down, he rebuilt. So we look at the places. He rebuilt the high places, the Bet Amot, these high places. Well, what's the purpose of them? The high places in the mind of the ancient Near East and Israel themselves was that any high place was a place where you meet God. Up on the mountaintops. Now, how many of you, like Mark and them, go up into the mountains? Mountaintops are pretty cool, aren't they? You get up there, there's snow up there when there's not snowy at place else. You know, you got clouds up in there. I think Mike and Karen, when they made their trip to Tennessee, you know, they go up into the mountains, and sometimes they get in the mountains and the clouds begin to settle down right about dusk. And so you want to get down out of the mountains before the clouds all settle in, because you can't see, can you? The fog just kind of settles in and then it settles on down. And to them, that was where God is. Getting to high places, that's where God is. And it's still that way today, isn't it? Where do you find shrines built? You go to the Himalayas, where do you find the shrines built? Is there not a shrine that's built on the way up to Mount Everest? Before you ever get to the top of the crest, isn't there a place that you stop off and you get all of these monks, and they're living there? They're not Catholic, they're Buddhist monks. And in this Buddhist monk temple, on your way up to Mount Everest, you've got this holy place, because in the mind of men, the mountains are a place where the gods dwell. And so it is for the ancient Near East. So they begin to build these high places back up, places for people to get up into the mountains and to go and worship. Building altars to Baal. What's wrong with Baal? Baal is an altar to prosperity. Baal is an altar to prosperity. Who wants to be poor? I won't ask who is poor. I just say, who wants to be poor? All right, no one wants to be poor. Who wants to be rich? I mean, who wants to be comfortable? All right, that's the same thing. Comfortable is rich. So we want to be well off. We want to be settled where we're not worrying about finances, right? I mean, that's kind of the mentality. That's what Baal offers. Because Baal is the cult to fertility. If you're an agricultural community, then what is prosperity? Your harvest. You know, you got the rain that you need in the spring, and you got the harvest, the crops begin to grow, and you get your summer fruit, and then you get your fall fruit, and you get a bumper crop that comes in, and you know that you're going to make it all the way through the winter. Now, we're going to celebrate Thanksgiving, not too distant down in the future. And when we think about Thanksgiving, and we think about the first winter, actually the first two winters that the pilgrims lived in, when they settled in like Plymouth Rock and up along in Maine and that area, what was the hardship for them? They generally landed, they had no clue what the climate was going to be like, what kind of crops grew, and they came here expecting to live off of fish or live off of what was ever there, and they starved to death the first winter and the second winter because they were eating the seed. There was nothing, and they had harvested nothing, and they had not prepared the soil, and it was very difficult. They lost most of their people in the first winter, right? Then the Indians come along and they show them corn. And they figure out they can plant corn and they can eat corn. And that, you know, fish help putting the protein around the seed with these dead fish helps to make the corn produce even greater. And so they begin to put the fish and the protein in there, and they begin to have bumper crops, and then they begin to have this harvest celebration. And so in a sense, we're the same way. We want to be able to winter out well because we have made it all the way through the year. And that's what Baal is. Baal for them is that he is the god of prosperity, that you have prospered. Then it says, he also worshiped the heavenly host, and he served them. In fact, he built altars in the Lord's temple, in the inner and the outer court, where God told Solomon, this is where I will put my name, and when you pray towards the temple, then I will hear your prayer from Jerusalem. He built altars, and it says he built altars to the whole heavenly host. And then he caused his sons to pass through the fire. What exactly is this? And I mentioned it before. There was a god called Molech. And Molech, the root of it means king. But this Molech god was a god of the Moabites, and the Amorites worshipped him, but he was a god of the of Canaanite culture, not Babylonian and not Sumerian. It's not something Abraham brought with him, but it was something that was there when he got there, when he landed in Canaan. And it was because the Babylonians and the Syrians and the Sumerians and Ur, the Chaldees, did not do human sacrifice. It was not part of their worship. They never did that. It was never part of their worship in that part of the world. But in Canaan, it was. The Phoenicians did human sacrifice. The Canaanites did human sacrifice. And they did human sacrifice even down in Egypt. And so all the peoples among whom Abraham landed, they were accustomed to doing human sacrifices. Well, what is the easiest thing to sacrifice? Let me ask you a question. What's more valuable, your son or your goat? To some of you, you would say your son, right? But your son's not going to bring you any money, is he? Now, initially, when people land in a place and the tribe is small, then people are valuable. But when the community grows and there's sufficient enough people, then livestock becomes more valuable than human life. And so the goats became, and the sheep became more valuable than sons and daughters. In the economy of things, there was a value put upon things. Is there any parallel today of the value put on human life? Since 1973, there has been. In January 11th of 1973, there was a Supreme Court decision called Roe v. Wade that put a lesser value on human life. One of the architects of the new health care plan has given us a new bell curve. You know what a bell curve is? Anyone here in teaching knows what a bell curve is? Well, there's a new bell curve. And the bell curve says that a human life has no value until about 18 months to 2 years old. Why? Because they don't understand tomorrow. They make no plans for the future. All they know is today. And so within the context of a healthcare system, as we limit healthcare because of the economic costs, then a child has no value, no community value, economic value, or nothing to offer society until about 18 months or 2 years, when he becomes self-conscious and he knows the difference between yesterday and today. And his value begins to accelerate and go up pretty rapidly. And he comes to the top of the bell curve somewhere between 35 and 40. That's important to know if you're not 35 or 40. But what about you folks that have gone over the edge? What is middle age anyway? Anyone here have an idea? What is middle age? Somebody give me, what's middle age, Trey? When you turn 50? Let me ask you a question. Look around. How many 100-year-old people do you see in here? How much? You may be much closer. You may be much closer. Really? I mean, look around. When we look around, the maximum age in this room is what? I hate to ask you any of your ages, but is anyone here over 85 in this room? Now, if I ask that in the Sunday morning, we do have some, don't we? But for the most part, let's just say 85. 86. Let's make 86 to be easier to round. 43. 43 becomes the median age, doesn't it? So someplace between 38 and 45, 46 becomes the prime area. Then what happens after that? Then you go off the bell curve. And the bell curve begins to go down. And someplace around the age of 63 to 65, you begin to plateau. And it kind of shrinks off and it goes on a longer track, because you are aware of today and tomorrow, and you do make plans for the future, but it begins to slow decline until someplace around 78 to 80, again, you have no value, because you produce nothing to the economy. Well, these kids are producing nothing to the economy, and the goats are worth more than the people. And so in order to appease the gods, then they would offer their children as a sacrifice to the deity, to the Queen of Heaven. Jeremiah talked about it quite a bit. And so these offerings to the starry host would be that you would have a god or a goddess, and it would be a bronze statue with arms turned down like this, which gave the symbol that it was opening and welcoming you, but it really didn't, because there was a fire pit at the end of their arms. And so with the arms turned down, if you lay a body on that, what's going to happen? They're going to roll down unless they hang on. But you know what? When you've got a bronze arm that's over a fire pit, how long are you going to be able to hang on? Not long. In fact, you're going to be letting go pretty quickly because it's hot. And where are you going to fall? Directly into the fire pit. And so they're in archaeology at the foot of the Hill of David in Jerusalem, down in what is this Jezreel, or down this valley, Valley of Hinnah, or Gehenna. Geh meaning valley, Hinnah is this valley of trash, and we get the term hell from this valley of Gehenna, which is the trash pit that constantly burns. And in there, in clay urns, they find all kinds of human bones. And the human bones are of the range of an infant of 1 year old up into about three. Why? Because, for example, when we were in Africa, the children, when we were doing evangelism, the children had no value. Why? Because child mortality was so great that the child really had no value, a human value, within society until it reached about eight. Why? Because any childhood disease could take the life. And so when we began to share the gospel with these little kids, they looked at us like we were just dropped in from a foreign planet. You know, why are you talking to the kids? Talk to the adults. And we didn't understand the connection until later we talked to some of the young men that were in the ministry there, and they said, well, you know, kids in our culture really don't have a value until, you know, somewhere around 8 to 12 years old, because so many of them die in childhood. And so there's just not a real value put on their life until they've made it long enough that they're going to be part of the clan, part of the family, they're going to produce, and they're going to be part of the life of it. And that's what happens. You know, how many of you have ever visited cemeteries in older communities and looked at the gravestones? Anyone here ever do that? I mean, it's a fascinating thing. And how often have you seen a mother who has died with her infant child? Or you go to the cemetery and you see kids that are from 1 year old to 8 years old, that their headstones in there because they have died in child mortality. And so they didn't have value. And so you offer these kids that have no value, you offer them to the gods to appease the gods, and you keep your goat. Because the goat's going to have, in the course of its lifetime, it's probably going to have 7 to 8 litters. And so having 1 to 2 goats, it will produce more for you community-wise than what your kid's going to. It's going to give back more. And so we live in a culture that puts a value upon human life. Who can give and who can't give? And it's not just for the children, is it? You know, one of the things that came up in my Sunday school class about this health care issue was this. Josh and Wesley are pretty sharp. And they both came in and said, you know, under this system, we wouldn't get health care. We are not important. We have no value. They're pretty sharp. Because they're right. And they picked it up pretty quickly. But you know, that is a cultural issue of the value that we put on people. Manasseh had no value on human life. Manasseh had no value. He was king. He was the shepherd over the sheep. And he did not put value upon the people. Not only did he not put value upon the people, he didn't even put value upon his own children. Because it was his kids that he put through the fire. He was into witchcraft, into divination, and every kind of thing. In verse 7 it says, Manasseh set up carved images of Asherah, she's a fertility goddess, and put them in the temple of the Lord, that the Lord had spoken to David and his son Solomon, I will establish my name here forever in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes. And I will never again cause the feet of the Israelites to wander from this land that I give to their ancestors, if only they will be careful to do all that I have commanded them, the whole law that my servant Moses commanded them. But they did not listen. Manasseh caused them to stray, so that they did greater evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. How far can a people of God go before God looks at us being more detestable than the people that he's punishing, than the people that he has rejected? How far can we go? Is there a limit to the point that God will put up with us? I suggest that there is. I think that's exactly what 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is talking about. It says, because they refused to judge their own body within the context of the Lord's Supper, that for that cause many of them had fallen asleep. It didn't mean what happens in the church on Sunday morning. You know, it wasn't what was going on in the choir. You know, it wasn't what was happening out here in the congregation. That's not what I'm talking about. Some of them had died. Some were sick. And the congregation was very ill. Because they had not judged themselves, God was judging them. Will God judge a congregation? Will he judge you? Even more important, will he judge me? And I see enough heads out there that it's pretty affirmative. I think you're convinced that he will, won't he? God's not going to tolerate our willful disobedience. And yet God made wonderful promises to them. God gave them promises of what he would do, and he reminds them of them in verse 8, but they wouldn't listen. They refused to listen, and Manasseh continued them down the path that would lead to their destruction. The Lord spoke through his servant the prophet, saying, since Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed all these abominations, greater evil than the Amorites who preceded him had done, and by means of his idols has also caused Judah to sin, this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I am about to bring such a disaster on Jerusalem and Judea that everyone who hears it will shudder. I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line used on Samaria and the mason level used on the house of Ahab, and I will wipe Jerusalem clean as one wipes a bowl, wiping it and turning it upside down. And I will abandon the remnant of my inheritance and hand them over to their enemies. And they will be plundered and spoiled to all of their enemies because they have done what is evil in my sight and provoked me from the day their ancestors came out of Egypt until today. You see, it's a persistent behavior like I talked about this morning. It was their nature to do so. And the only way to have a change is for the grace of God to change us, isn't it? Because when did this begin? When Manasseh became king? No. They've been doing this. They've been provoking God from the day that he delivered them from Egypt. Well, let me ask you the question. How long have you and I been provoking God? In the way that we treat God in our own Christian life, how long do we provoke God? How long have we been? Is there a good reason for God to discipline us as a person, as an individual, or a congregation? I think there's sufficient reason. I really do. I think God's asking for us. I think God is compelling us. I think God's commanding us that there's got to be a behavior that is equivalent with the character that we're supposed to bear. It's one thing for me to tell someone else I'm a Christian. It's another one thing for someone to look at me and say, you've got to be a Christian. What's the difference? One's my personal evaluation of how well I'm doing. The other one's the evaluation of someone who sees my life and evaluates it. And I am the quarterback of the... But I have had no one ask me for my autograph on my jersey or ask me for a helmet. And it's not going to happen because I'm not the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. I hate to bust the bubble after almost 12 years, but I'm not the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. But I can say that, can't I? My behavior does not fit my conversation. And so it is, Jesus said, baptizing them, teaching them two things. That there is the commitment, there's the visual commitment, and then there is the inner commitment that we are following what Jesus has asked us to do. If we're not following, then what's wrong with the picture? Wearing the jersey doesn't mean I'm on the team, does it? Just because I go and buy a jersey, and I might get, you know, Peyton Manning's jersey and get the Colts and get my brother to get him to sign it for me, but it doesn't put me on the team, does it? It will not put me on the team just because I wear the jersey. The visible thing has got to be seen by what really is on the inside. Manasseh also shed so much innocent blood that he filled Jerusalem with it from one end to the other. This was in addition to the sins that he caused Judah to commit, so that they did what was evil in the Lord's sight. And the rest of the events of Manasseh, along with all of his accomplishments and the sin he committed, are written about in historical records of Judah's kings. Manasseh, rested with his fathers, was buried in his own garden, in his own house, the garden of Uzzah. His son, Amon, became king in his place. Exactly what did he do? What one thing does it commend him for in this chapter? I'll tell you what it does it does emphasize and iterate. He's a wicked sinner. He sinned worse than anybody that was before him. And in his sin, something that he did by his own choice is he wasn't buried with his fathers. You know, every other king that reigned over Jerusalem, it says, and they were buried with their fathers, with their father David, in the city of Jerusalem. But Manasseh wasn't buried with his fathers. He was buried outside of the city in his own garden spot and never saw the importance of his relationship and heritage as being a son of Israel. We look at his second son, or the next son, And this one, well, he's a bit older. Amon was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 2 years. Quite a stellar time and accomplishment. And his mother's name was Meshulamah, the daughter of Haruz. And she was from Jotbah. He did what was evil on the Lord's side, as his father Manasseh had done. He walked in all the ways his father had walked. He served the idols his father had served. He worshipped them. He abandoned the Lord God of his ancestors, did not walk in the way of the Lord. Ammon's servants conspired against him, the king, and they killed him in his own house. Then the common people executed all that had conspired against King Ammon, and made his son Josiah king in his place. And the rest of the events of Ammon's reign, along with his accomplishments, are written about in the historical record of Judah's kings. And he was buried in the tomb in the garden of Uzzah, and his son Josiah became king in his place. What is there to commend to this man? Absolutely nothing. And where was he buried? With David, his father? With the ancestors in the city of David? No, with the same wicked man that had taught him. When we look at our lives, we make an influence. There is an influence of our life, like it or not, choose to or not. It's just like pro athletes that come out and say, well, I didn't intend to be a role model. Well, guess what? It comes with the territory, doesn't it? I didn't choose to be a role model to other people. Guess what? It comes with the territory. Just being born, you're a role model to somebody, aren't you? John talked about his infant 20-year reunion, you know, of the 20-year child reunion. Because I've graduated, been out of college longer than that. No. But 20 years, and he talked about the influence that he had in that short span of 20 years, and in high school, the influence that he had had, and the things that had gone on in life of those that were there. And every one of us, the people we work with, the people that we have known, we've grown up with, we lived around, the people that we've been in Sunday school with or church, the people in the community that we've been employed with or not been employed with. There's this Hispanic fellow that goes out to the nursing home every Sunday. And he goes to sit with a man and his father. And his whole reason for going there is he's not related. But he goes there religiously, faithfully, every single Sunday. You'll see him, even if the son's not there. And he goes, and what does he share in common? Well, the son and he both served together in Vietnam. And they were both in the Marines. And they both got out together. They were brothers in arms. And they worked together and retired together from the plan. And so these two are friends that are closer than brothers. And this gentleman wasn't a Christian when he began. But the son is a Christian. And the dad's a Christian. And just because of the brotherhood of what they shared in common of their time in Vietnam and their time working together at Valero, he has had an influence that this man has now become a believer in Jesus Christ, a follower of Jesus Christ. And so every Sunday, even if the son can't be there because he still contracts out to work, this man shows up to see his dad, this other guy's dad, every week. He rolls him out to the front, and they sit out there and watch the birds, and they feed the birds. Every Sunday, he makes sure that his dad gets outside. He makes sure that his dad's dressed and his dad's clean. He makes sure that his dad gets into the dining room so that he's there for supper every single Sunday. What influence has that young man had on this fellow? I would say great in every way, wouldn't you? Something happened in the life that this guy's life is forever changed because of a relationship. How about us? What kind of changes are we making in people's lives because they're connected to us? I'd like you to think about this. This is an assignment week. I haven't given you an assignment in a long time. This is assignment week. This week, I want you to pray about and look around and ask yourself this question. Whose life have I made a big impact on? Whose life have I made a big impact on? How? My influence in their life, how has it changed their life? And I don't want you to write me no more than one page, but keep it short. maybe a half a page or just a few sentences, one paragraph, and don't put your name on it, but just to write and say, here's a person, give the first name and say, here's a person, here's how I've known them, and here's how my knowing them has made a difference in their life. Would you do it? Would you be willing to do that? And you can give it to me anonymously because I don't want your name on it. Because I'd like us to begin to think. Because if we don't think, we're probably not going to actively do anything to be an influence on anyone. But you think about one person, and I know there's got to be more, so it ought to be easy. I'm just limiting it to one person. How have you influenced their life for better? In the time that you have known them and they have known you, what difference have you made in their life? You know what? Manasseh made a difference, didn't he? He had a son that was just like him. Hezekiah could have made a great difference in Manasseh's life, but the last part of it, he didn't care how he ran it. He was no longer cared about life and death issues and how he walked because he knew he had 15 years. He knew that he was going to be around. And he knew he was going to live to a ripe old age, so it didn't matter. All of his plans would be settled out in that time, so it didn't make any difference. And guess what? He didn't make a positive difference, did he? Not in the end. What kind of difference are we making? Father God, as we stand in your holy presence, help us to be honest as we look at this project. God, to see what kind of influence we are on people that know us.